Welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for August 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am not joined today by my co-host, Tim Nelson. Tim could not be with us this month. He has had a busy string with his family and some events going on. He's actually on vacation right now, so we could not get the stars to align, but it's actually really cool because we have, for the first time in our podcast history, a special guest with us today. His name is Jason Thompson, and he is a friend of mine. We met about a year ago, and Jason is super passionate about film, and we've got to see some films together, have some really cool discussions, and he just has a really great eye for drawing connections between film and faith, things that I often don't notice, and it's remarkable. And he also is really good at references to other films, and I just love talking with him. So he was my first choice when I was looking for a guest, and so I just I'm really excited to have him on. So Jason, welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for that welcome and that introduction.
Absolutely. So before we get into what we're going to be talking about today, I thought just give you a chance if you could introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners, tell us what you're all about, and yeah, go for it.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, so my story from the standpoint of just the interest in cinema and film actually began 20 years ago, and I can remember watching, among all films, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. You know, it's not exactly high art, and it's a little campy. It's one of those films, you know, everybody likes. And I can't really explain what it was. Not that it's necessarily a masterpiece of a film, but I think from the standpoint of the kinds of films that I'd seen previously, you know, as a kid, I'd mostly been exposed to more mainstream cinema, hadn't really seen a whole lot of independent film. There was something about it that just struck me. And again, it's really unexplainable. And it was like senior year of high school. So, you know, all those questions of what am I going to major in? What am I going to do with my life?
Sure.
And for some reason, something registered and said, that's what I want to do right there. Little did I know that I was among scores of other kids that had seen that and decided they were going to.
Tarantino has inspired quite a few aspiring filmmakers, yes.
And I have to confess this. I'm removed far enough from it to finally be able to just honestly confess that when I did finally go to school to study film, I was too embarrassed to admit that, you know, this film was the one that actually kind of interested me in going into cinema. Just because I didn't want to seem like, you know, it just seems so cliche, like everybody's trying to imitate. But listen.
I have to admit, I have heard from more than one person, I saw Pulp Fiction and, you know, dot, dot, dot. It's all good. It's all good.
So it's, I think God's dealt with me enough over the years to give me the humility to say that, yeah, that was probably sort of the defining moment that made me say, I want to study film. So I enrolled and went to school and studied, did my undergrad in, we didn't have an actual film program. So the department was communication arts, and there was three different concentrations. So I chose radio, TV, film. And the school I was at really wasn't heavy on production per se. They were heavier on theory. But we did a handful of actual hands-on physical production work. And so that's really how my interest in getting into cinema began. And as we were talking about before we got the podcast started, I think that, you know, maybe indirectly my mother might be responsible for my interest in cinema.
Okay.
When she was, I don't know if it was she was teaching at UWM or if she was a student there, one or the other, but she claims that when she was pregnant with me that she went to a lot of film festivals, and she always talked a lot about going to see Ingmar Bergman films.
Okay.
And the two that she referenced as being really impactful were Cries and Whispers and Seventh Seal. And I like Bergman. And actually, and incidentally, a lot of Bergman films have a lot of religious themes running through them. If I'm not mistaken, I think he came from a Catholic background. So if you see, for example, in fact, UWM about 15 years ago did a Bergman series in their festival. And there's one called Persona has a lot of references actually directly to the cross. Seventh Seal is just rife with those kind of medieval Christian symbolisms. Through a Glass Darkly is another one as well. Some of the other films are a little more subtle, like Wild Strawberries. But anyway, so Mom was going to see Ingmar Bergman films.
And you were soaking it up in vitro. Nice.
I think so.
Awesome.
And actually, interestingly enough, like even before, because I remember watching Pulp Fiction, I picked it up at the rental store in the spring of 96. But that previous fall of 95, Mom was also a great collector of, Mom had a huge collector of albums. And so maybe someday in the distant future we'll do a podcast on music, because Mom had like almost every record ever created.
Nice.
And she had a ton of just films. So she was like a huge, just like, you know, really just deep into culture in that respect. And I remember she ordered through the video club the 1971 Shaft. And so that was like summer of 95. And my buddy and I saw that. And we were like, yes, you know. So, and to this day, I still say that the Richard Roundtree Shaft, the first one, is the authentic Shaft. I'm sorry, the Samuel Jackson sort of reboot just doesn't cut it. So we watched Shaft, and there was a storytelling contest the fall of 95, our senior year, in literature class, where we were reading the Canterbury Tales. And so the assignment was to tell your own narrative. So what we did was we decided to combine Shaft with sort of an Indiana Jones theme, and the little 10-minute video that we put together, and I think it still exists, because it was my uncle had the camcorder, and so I'm sure at my uncle's house somewhere he's got the raw cut of. I don't want anybody to watch it, by the way, but it was Shaft and the Rod of Moses. So instead of looking for the Ark, he's going to look for the Rod of Moses, and so that was kind of like a cool experience. Like, wow, this is kind of cool. So then several months later, you know, I pick up Pulp Fiction and I see Samuel Jackson, which I still think is one of Samuel Jackson's best performances, and something just like registered. And I don't know if it was just being in the womb, indirectly watching Bergman films and seeing Shaft. And then finally, maybe Tarantino was like the straw that broke the camel's back that said, yes, this is what you're doing. So incidentally, I finished up my studies. And when I went into my undergrad studies, I was not a believer. In fact, I was virtually an atheist. And so, for the most part, I had sort of a foggy idea that there might be a God. There's sort of this unidentified something out there. And oddly enough, my point of reference for thinking that there's something vague out there that's undefined was creation. So just as Paul kind of mentions in Romans that, you know, the fact of creation bears witness, like, I feel like, yeah, like I lived what he's talking about there. That something in me wouldn't let me utterly deny that there's a creator, because I could look at the design and creation.
Yeah.
So I'm saying all that to say that, incidentally, by the time that I finished up my undergrad studies in cinema was the time that I was converted to faith.
Oh, beautiful.
And so somehow in that, though, I felt God changing the direction of my life. And so I did away with all my cinema stuff.
Okay.
I have sort of an interesting story. I have a niece who's going to be starting at Columbia College this fall in theater, and she's almost exactly 20 years younger. And I've been telling her, like, yeah, I was a student at Columbia College for like 3 days. So I had gotten into their master's program, and for some financial reasons, I had to bail out. But at the same time, I felt like, well, God's kind of changing my life and direction. So realistically, like, I've been out of the loop from the standpoint of cinema for probably like 15 years. And I think around the time that you and I met was when I really got back into sort of picking up traction, watching films again.
So there's some holes, is what you're saying.
There are a lot of holes. So, like, I know you and I have talked about, like, like, I think you and I have, like, our own time periods of, like, where we're unfamiliar with, like, because I think, like, so it's kind of,
absolutely. You mention films sometimes, and I'm like, nope. And they're classics, and I know they're classics. And then I'll say, you know, Schindler's List, and nothing. So it's all good.
So I don't know if, in the providence of God, like, that 13 to 15 year stretch was, like, time enough for the gospel to soak in. And now, and I don't want to think for, like, I don't know the mind of God, but just to the extent that, you know, my puny human mind can reason, I'm just kind of wondering, like, maybe this is sort of that time of, okay, now the gospel's kind of soaking in. Let's get back into viewing I don't know, but
that's cool. No, yeah. I feel the same in that way. It's like, you know, before I started this project and the website and the podcast and everything, I feel like there was this definite period where I too kind of, I never really let go of film, but there was this period where I was more focused on theology and just developing what I believe. And I don't think I would be able to write the way I write and talk the way I talk if I hadn't had that period of kind of deconstruction of my faith and building it back up again and actually asking, what do I believe? So that foundation is so important. I think that's really cool. Yeah, that's great, man. Thanks for sharing. That's awesome. I didn't know any of that. It's great. Awesome. So we are going to be talking today about a film that was something I've been looking forward to seeing for quite a while. Is on, you know, there's these films that come out of the festival circuit, and you just, all you hear about, I don't unfortunately have the privilege of attending a lot of festivals, so I hear about it through Twitter and everything, and everyone has been talking about this movie called Hell or High Water, and starring Chris Pine, who most of you will probably know from Star Trek. He is Captain Kirk in Star Trek, in the new rebooted Star Trek that J.J. Abrams started. I've been hearing about this film, and so I was so excited to see it, and I'm happy to say that it definitely lived up to the hype for me. I thought it was fantastic. It's a truly good movie, and it's just right off the bat, it's great to see Chris Pine in a completely different role than I was used to. You know, so let's just sum up the plot a second. So the movie's Hell or High Water, and it's about... It's about two brothers who we meet right off the bat robbing a bank, and they're in this point of their life where they are going on this spree of robbing banks, and we don't know why, and so we follow them on these exploits, and then that's juxtaposed with this Texas Ranger, played by Jeff Bridges, who is with his partner, and they are trying to catch the people who are robbing banks. So you kind of have these dual partnerships that the movie tracks between these two brothers who are robbing the banks and this Texas Ranger and his partner who are trying to catch them. And that's what the film is about. And yeah, like I said, the hype lived up to it. It was every bit as good as I was expecting. And honestly, I thought this was one of the best films I've seen this year. Would you agree, Jason, from what you've seen so far in 2016?
Definitely. And I've only seen a handful of 2016 films. Sure. But yeah, I would agree with you. Probably I would say this is probably the best film I've seen this year.
Mm-hmm. And so let's dive in. Now, the movie takes place in Texas, and it really feels like it. There is a really cool sense of presence of that Texas landscape, and I'm not just making that up, because I was actually in Texas once. I can claim that. For a week, I was there, and so I remember the feeling of it. A friend of mine was going off out of the country to go live in Istanbul, and he's like, this is a friend I grew up with since I was a kid, and so it's like, we got to do one crazy thing, right? And for us sheltered suburban Midwesterners, crazy means going to someplace we've never been. So we went to Texas, and that was crazy for us, because you got to understand, you know, living in the Midwest, we don't have any creatures here that can hurt us, and the elements aren't really a factor. And so going to a place where there actually was mountain lions and bears and tarantulas and scorpions, it was pretty cool. So we went to Big Bend National Park, and we went out there to Texas, and I remember it just being so beautiful, like looking out into the distance and seeing all of these rolling hills and these mountain ranges. I mean, they're not really mountains, but they look like it from a distance. And it's hot, but it's not like, at least when I was there, it wasn't like oppressive heat. It was just this really beautiful heat. And got my first cowboy hat, authentic. I asked for the Indiana Jones cowboy hat because I didn't like what I was seeing. I was looking at the rack, and there's all these like, that's not, because when I have to look at a cowboy hat, it's got to be like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? And so she was like, oh, you want the Indiana Jones cowboy hat? And she led me to this like back room, and they had it right there. So I bought that. I still got it. My kids like put paint all over it, but it's okay. It's still in operation. And so I went to Texas, and it was great. And it really, so the movie really captures this feeling of what Texas is like, at least that I remember it. Have you ever been to Texas, Jason?
Yes, I have been a handful of times. Okay. To Texas.
Did it feel authentic to you?
You know, the times that I've been to Texas, I've been more to the metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. But like you and I talked the night after we walked out of the film, you know, Mom, again, the film aficionado that she is, She's a real appreciator of Altman films.
Okay, yeah.
And she was telling me about an Altman film. I don't remember which one it is, but there's an Altman film that takes place. Oh, you know what? No, I remember now. She's confusing Altman with Robert Benton. Robert Benton directed a film, and I think Altman is from Waxahachie, Texas, because mom grew up like on a farm part of her life, and she grew up, and she spent some years in Waxahachie, Texas. But she always references Places in the Heart with Sally Field and Danny Glover, and I believe John Malkovich is in it as well, Ed Harris. Great cast. Very good film. Takes place sort of in the Depression era. And if you see it, it has that same Texas feel. Mom said, like, that's very authentic in terms of, like, it captures it. So, yeah, I'm sure that, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was that one thing, and I don't know if this is the point to introduce that or not, but remember we were talking after the film, and I remember thinking to myself, like, this movie is so Texan that there's that one scene where they're in the lawyer's office, and I'm looking at the lawyer's office, and I'm thinking, there's not even a picture of the current sitting president. There's a picture of LBJ. Like, that's how Texan
there you go.
This film is.
It's in the details, that, yeah.
And there was another shot. There was someone else in the photo next to it, but that's one of the things I noticed. But yeah, it's very Texan.
Even the final shot of the film that, like, the camera actually goes down low right into the weeds, and you kind of, like, hear the, you know, the bugs in the air, and, and yeah, that's they really captured it.
Yeah.
And so I mentioned Chris Pine, and he really does an about face here, which is refreshing, because like I said, I'm so used to him as Captain Kirk, and when he's have you seen Star Trek? I don't think that's one of them.
No, I haven't seen any of the
reboots. It's really good, at least the first one. But the thing about his character version of Captain Kirk is that he's so, like, energetic and cocky, and he's a womanizer, and he's just, like, bouncing around from one thing to the next. And this role is so different from that. He's very quiet and kind of soft spoken, kind of this just thoughtful moral center of the film, right? And he's got just this really quiet presence, and so I that was awesome, and he does a great job. And I remember reading an interview with him where he was saying how this is what he wants. I mean, this is, like, where his passion is, you know. I mean, you could almost sense in between the words that he doesn't hate Star Trek, he's still doing it, but he wants something beyond that, and this film is, like, was so great for him for that. And so you have this, so he's one half of this brother duo, and so he's, like, the quiet, soft-spoken, and then he's juxtaposed with his other brother, played by Ben Foster, who is the exact opposite of that. This guy, fresh out of prison, and constantly, I think, one step away from prison, he's just a live wire. Like, everywhere he goes, he's always doing something that's getting him into trouble, and he's everywhere, and so he's loud and he's obnoxious, and that is Ben Foster's character. So these two brothers and their dynamic, it's just, they got really good chemistry together, and there's a lot of really cool moments where they just feel like brothers. There's that, you know, that one scene where there's no dialogue, it was just kind of showing them by this fence and just hanging out and goofing around, and yeah, it was cool.
And you got the sense in that moment, I know exactly that scene you're talking about, because that's that scene where, and this could be me, like, overanalyzing, and sometimes I have that tendency to just read way too much into a shot, but remember I was saying that I think I saw the cross in that one shot where you've got, like, the twilight, it's like twilight, the sky is kind of opaque, and there's, like, all these telephone poles, and it almost looks like a cloud floats by perpendicular, but in that moment, as like you said, that there's a horsing around.
Yeah,
I got the sense, like, this is what they did as kids.
Exactly. Yes. That's cool, man. And yeah, and then so you have these brothers, and then, like I said, there's this other partnership that we're introduced to, where played by Jeff Bridges. And Jeff Bridges is this Texas Ranger, and he's really gruff, kind of overweight. He's, to me, this is like stereotypical Texas sheriff kind of guy, right? And he's It's cool. It's a great role for Jeff Bridges. He plays it so well, and I don't think it doesn't seem like it takes that much effort for him. It just comes natural to him. It feels like to me like he's just born to play roles like that. Kind of like Tommy Lee Jones. I don't know if you I just saw him in the new Jason Bourne, but he's always like the powerful guy in a suit, and it just like feels like it works every single time, but you gotta think that he can just kind of sit down and just do it. You know, it's like built into his blood. But anyway, so Jeff Bridges is great as this Texas Ranger guy, and he's partnered up with this other guy named Alberto, I think is his name. And he's like this guy, he's like part Native American, part Mexican, and I only bring that up because Jeff Bridges' character is kind of a jerk. He's kind of like, he's always making these racist comments against his partner, and you know, and he clearly, Alberto doesn't like this, but at the same time, there's always that slight hint of a smile, you know, because you can almost feel like these people have been partners for quite a long time, and this is sort of how they bond. This is their weird, quirky intimacy, this, you know, and yeah, so that was really interesting, because it's kind of offensive in a way, because he's making horrible comments that no one should make, but at the same time, it's kind of their dynamic. Yeah, I don't know. Did you find it offensive? I mean, what's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I think my take is a little bit different.
Yeah, go for it.
You know, as I leaned over to you in the theater, I said, man, this is extremely politically incorrect, which I think sometimes we need that. I think that our culture and our society has become so tense and we're so afraid of offending so many different groups of people that I think we kind of overdo it. I mean, I'm all for being sensitive and mm-hmm. respectful of different cultures and different kinds of people. But sometimes I think that there's just such a tension about not wanting to say this, that, or the other, that to me it's... It's refreshing when you have that crass, crude character who really just doesn't care. And like we were talking in the diner after the film, he really reminded me a lot of Archie Bunker, you know, America's favorite TV racist, you know, where there's like this. Yeah, I mean, I get it. On the one level, it's crude, it's crass, it's offensive. And you understand that a lot of that has to do with that culture. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting growing up over the years, I remember hearing quite often from different individuals, you know, some of our family lived in the South, some of our family lived in the North. And one of the things that you often heard was that, you know, racism in the North is different than racism in the South, because in the North, the people that are prejudiced and racist, they mask it and they'll smile and grin. But, you know, the reality is they don't like you. Well, in the South, people are just out front, like, you know yeah. who's bigoted
yeah, yeah.
and who's not. Another film that comes to mind, not just Archie Bunker, but incidentally the same actor portrays this character in the TV series In the Heat of the Night with Rod Steiger and Sidney Poitier. Another powerful classic film dealing with that Southern culture, race, ethnicity, and just their dynamic there as... Poitier plays Virgil Tibbs, an officer from the North who comes down. I can't remember the specifics of the plot, but he has a reason to come to the South, and he hooks up with Rod Steiger's character, whom Carol O'Connor plays in the TV series later with Howard Rollins, and you see that dynamic where it's like there's a bond, but you know that there's still like that racial tension. And so I thought it spoke to a deep theme that runs throughout the film in terms of like there's a lot of dealing with not just the fact like, oh, this is Texas, but there's a lot of questions of like culture, and there's tons of intersection, and not to get ahead of, you know, where we are in the yeah. podcast, but there's really this question of like, you have a lot of things going on, just a lot of dimensions from the standpoint of like, you've got culture, you've got race, ethnicity, language, heritage, and all these different intersecting lines. And I think that characterization of Jeff Bridges' character, I think it fit well with that. Like you could see that this guy might be full of like racist views and ignorant views, but underneath there, he's actually got a heart. And it's so evident, especially there's a couple of moments like when he's telling, I guess, Alberto, he tells Alberto, you know, because he's on the brink of retirement. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Bridges' character, Marcus, he tells Alberto, you know, the thing you're going to miss about me is my constant teasing and harassing. And then there's that moment where, and this is a spoiler alert.
Briefly, just come back in like 10 seconds. Yeah.
Well, let me try to say it in a way that's not so spoilerish.
Okay.
When something happens to yep. Alberto.
Okay.
Yep. You know, that's pretty...
Could be anything.
Yeah. The immediate reaction that you see lets you know that, like, this guy knows that, yeah, this is a racist, prejudiced jerk, but damn, you know, he's my friend, mm-hmm. and he really does care about me.
Yeah, so, and there's definite compassion in Jeff Bridges' eyes when it... Yeah, exactly.
But you said something interesting I wanted to just kind of come back to, mm-hmm. and I like what you said about the dynamic between Ben Foster and Chris Pine's character about how... I can't remember exactly the specific language that you used, but you said something to the effect of how there's this kind of unusual bond or mm-hmm. this odd like connection that they have. And I think that that's something that you see even with Marcus and Alberto.
Yes.
Is that, so here's like a coupling of like these two relational dynamics where there's just this strange bond, because even with the two brothers, there's that moment where he indicates... He's talking about the reasons why he joined. I think Chris Pine was the younger brother, right?
Yes.
So mm-hmm. he talks about the reasons why they're going through the whole litany of reasons why he joined his little brother in this heist. And I just love what he says. He says, because you asked me to. Mm-hmm. And there's that moment where he actually says, when they're about to separate and go their separate ways, he says, man, I love you, brother. And so, yeah, there's that sense in which, and I don't know if that maybe speaks to a deeper question of, you know, and this maybe relates even to like when we went and saw Suicide Squad, this idea of like sinners, can sinners know anything about love?
Yeah.
You know, can broken, messed up people really know anything about love and relationship? And I say, yeah.
It's like even the phrasing of that question, it almost presumes, which I think we all run into this yeah. problem, that we aren't broken and that
right,
they are, right?
Right
and
right.
So exactly, it's yeah. like we are all
yeah, yeah.
like groveling at the foot of the cross. And yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, that's good. So then I want to get to the cinematography is pretty epic. So let's go with the script. So this guy, the movie was written by this guy named Taylor Sheridan, who actually wrote Sicario. Did you see Sicario? This is from last year.
I did not, but I read your review on it.
Yes, and it was really good, and unfortunately super underrated. Like, I was wanting it to you know, get some of the major award considerations, but it didn't. It just, for some reason, I mean, it came out in October. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I really felt like it was definitely in the top five movies I saw that year, and I think it deserved better. But anyway, it really was a great film. And so, same writer, and the dialogue in this movie, it's like one of those scripts where you just, you hear some lines and you're like, yes, like that's so clever the way it's worded. Like there are some movies like you don't notice the dialogue because, you know, whatever, but this is one of those movies where there are at least three or four times where you actually pause and notice how greatly written that scene was, you know?
Did yeah. you like the dialogue in the opening sequence with the first teller that they encounter?
Which part specifically?
Where there's just that whole dynamic, the very first heist in the film, in the opening,
mm-hmm.
and there's just something in the dialogue and in the blocking that almost had kind of a slapstick element to it.
Mm.
And I just really enjoyed the banter and the dialogue, because there's that moment where she calls him stupid.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah. come back over here. I dare you to call me stupid again. And yeah. just... that will be, at least for me, one example of where I thought, wow, this is some pretty clever writing. Because even off the bat, I'm wondering, is this intended to be comedic or dramatic or a little mm-hmm. bit of both?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, throughout, I think the writing was very solid.
Yeah, example I wrote, I just had to write it down because it was so good, was when Jeff Bridges was talking, I think, to that teller, and he asked him if he was asking like if she could pick out their race beneath their masks, because they wore ski masks, and she was like, "So were they white? Were they black?" And she responds, "Their skin or their souls?" And he says, "Let's leave their souls out of it for now." Oh gosh, that's good writing. Love that. So, yeah, there's just a ton of lines like that, and it's just really clever. It's great. So that's a writer to keep your eye on right there. I mean, he's basically Sicario in this. I mean, whew, wow, he's going places. So, and it's directed by a guy named David McKenzie, who I cruised over to his IMDb page, and I didn't recognize any of those films. And but there were a lot of them. I mean, he's probably, look, he did like 12 films that I've never heard of. So, and one of them starred Tilda Swinton. So it's not like they're all like college projects or something. Like, I mean, I don't know. He must be super into the indie circuit, which I guess I'm not familiar enough with. But yeah, did you recognize any of the movies he's done?
I did not. I did the same thing. I went over to IMDb. And if I'm not mistaken, he's from Scotland.
Okay.
And there's a he did a collaboration on a previous film, I think, with Sheridan, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
For the credits, I can't. I think it's called. I'm not going to try to remember what it's called now.
That's okay.
But yeah, I did not. I'd never heard of Mackenzie.
Yeah.
I never heard of any of the films.
Well, I think we're going to hear from him from now on because this is quite the calling card. Yeah.
While we're on cinematography, can we please talk about that opening shot?
Oh yeah,
absolutely amazing.
Perfect. And there's a lot of one shot. Mm-hmm. How do you say that?
That long take.
Yes, long takes. Yes, that doesn't cut away. Right. So yeah, exactly. The movie opens with just this shot of this car cruising down the road, and then a woman walking, and the car rounds the building. And then we see a mural of three crosses, which is going to be very significant when we talk about the themes later on. But you've got one cross slightly extended above the other two. And then we keep panning and the car goes around. And then these two guys get out of the car and ski masks and rob this bank. And that's all in one shot. And it's perfect. Yeah, it is.
It's almost like a panoramic. I don't know if this is right or not, but I want to say it's like a 720 degree angle shot because it just goes almost in a complete circle.
Yep.
And incidentally, there's almost that feel to the film that there's a sense in which the film kind of comes full circle by the time it wraps up.
Yeah.
But
that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. The cinematography was excellent. There was that one moment that you had referenced right after we saw it, which I think was also powerful. One of our favorite scenes where these young punks pull up at the gas station and they taunt Ben Foster.
Yeah, he's just like chilling there. Like, you don't know if he's napping or whatever, but these guys come up. Yeah, go for it. Explain it. Sorry.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. And just the use of the long take there.
Uh-huh.
And I think more mainstream American films could really benefit from fewer cuts and better use of those long takes. Because it really just draws out a lot of the intensity of the shot.
Yeah.
And like you had, I like how you remarked that when Chris Pine comes into view, it's almost like you don't expect him to come out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this tension because we know the kind of character that Ben Foster's character is. We know what he's capable of. We know how erratic and wild he is. And in this shot, these two punks are yelling at him and taunting him. One of them flashes a pistol to show how tough he is. And then the whole shot, he's just leaning, just chilling.
Yeah. And you expect him to flip out at any moment.
Yes.
But it's not him. Out of nowhere, remember, it does not cut away, comes Chris Pine, who actually steps in and flips out. And it's so much more powerful with the camera just lingering there. It is. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. Yeah, it's really well-directed movie. It's just, you can tell it's one of those directing jobs where this guy is in control from minute one, and go ahead.
I wanted to also remark, I know this isn't specifically cinematography, mm-hmm. but loosely connected, I guess on the standpoint of the mise-en-scene, the use of music in this film.
Oh, music, go for it. Jump in, right, go for it,
But in the opening credits, I noticed Nick Cave. Now, I remember, as a kid growing up, I listened to a lot of indie rock and a lot of rock music. And I can remember that, when I was a kid, as a teenager, you'd get these, catalogs from different record labels, and you'd order your records and what have you. Had a big collection of vinyl. And I remember seeing Nick Cave's name a lot, so I'm familiar with who he is. I haven't listened to, a ton of his music.
I haven't either.
But I've been reading some articles, probably in the last couple of years, that have been talking about how, because Nick Cave's music is sort of that darker indie rock, a little bit has that kind of macabre tone to it. Not so much, it's not exactly goth, but it's almost goth, but not like in a cheesy Marilyn Manson kind of way,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of a classier kind of goth / indie style, kind of bluesy. And I've read a handful of articles in the last couple of years that have talked about the Christian themes that run throughout Nick Cave's music, but it also fits the very Texan setting. I remember seeing Nick Cave not too long ago on Austin City Limits, and he He just has that style about him that has that kind of Texas drawl, kind of twang. And as you listen to it, you know, it almost is, it's almost kind of like listening to like Johnny Cash with those kind of like old school, old country kind of themes of like themes of darkness, but yet that darkness is intermingled with redemption, which I think is extremely appropriate in Christianity. I mean, you read the Psalms and you hear that kind of dark, like just deathy, if that's even an adjective, tone that just pervades the Psalms. And you look at Jesus like in a garden praying, sweating blood, and there's this dark element to redemption that I think a lot of mainstream Christianity really wants to like avoid. You know, we prefer the happier sort of like upbeat side of things, and we have this sort of glossed over picture of Christianity. And I think that that's one of the things I thought the soundtrack really helped to kind of intensify that, you know, redemption in Christianity has this kind of dark undercurrent. Like God and Jesus are not afraid of intermingling and entangling with the darkness. And you can see that in Marcus, Jeff Bridges' character's relentless pursuit. One of the things that you and I had chuckled about that we both kind of agreed was very appropriate were those couple of moments in the film where mainstream Christianity is mocked. Christian rock is mocked. Uh-huh. Televangelists. And it's like...
It's perfect.
It's perfect because it's put in this context of... Well, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Jesus flipping out when he sees the money changers and this sort of commodification of religion.
Or the Pharisees, exactly. Yeah. It's good. And so did Nick Cave, was he featured in the film? Because I wouldn't recognize his voice, or did he just compile the soundtrack? Do you know?
He, in the opening credits, it indicates that he and another, and I do not remember the other songwriter or singer, but it says music and songs by Nick Cave and someone else. Okay. He's responsible for a lot of the music in it. And I remember there were certain like key lines that jumped out at me. Like, for example, like there's that night before like the really sort of like climactic scene, which hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that, where they go in and they realize, well, we're in over our heads.
Oh, yeah.
But there's that, and it's actually that scene that you had referenced where they're like horsing around and like the sun's setting. And there's something, if you listen to the lyrics, it definitely wasn't Nick Cave singing, it was a female vocalist, but the line says, "I'm not afraid to die." There's another lyric in there as well, but that's the one that kind of caught my attention. So, you know, it fits into that. You know, this is a Texan film. Mm-hmm. There's tons of these kind of redemptive kind of themes. Which fits as well, because it kind of gets into this question of, you know, like, how do we define and understand culture and cultural identity? Because certainly this is not a decisively explicit Christian film, certainly not in the way that we would understand so-called Christian movies. But just the abundance of sort of these metaphors that are very biblical in nature, you ask yourself, like, and this is sort of the way I felt when I watched Hail Caesar, to what extent... Well, and I thought about this relative to Hail Caesar in a different way, but with this film, to what extent is this some kind of unconscious influence on whatever background Sheridan or McKenzie had, or to what extent is this just part of the culture? Because, you know, Texas, I mean, that's Bible Belt. And these days, when it comes to conversations about religion, spirituality, you almost have to kind of disentangle it from, are we talking about this from a cultural standpoint or from a genuine faith standpoint? Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that it's ambiguous. It was ambiguous in Hail Caesar, not to get sidetracked, but when I watch Hail Caesar, the references to spiritual themes, I was always wondering, like, especially the scene with the different religious leaders arguing about...
Oh, I love that scene. That's one of the best scenes of the year. Yeah, for sure.
and I never... And certainly with me not being familiar with enough of the Coen stuff, I was constantly wondering, like, is this an endorsement or is this, you know? And so that was the same thing here.
Mm-hmm. And it was good music. Like, you know, and I generally hate country music. It's just totally not my thing. But this is the kind I can tolerate. Like, it's not that, you know, mainstream pop country. It's just, it felt really authentic, and I love that. It's like more blues, right, kind of thing, but with a darker edge, like you said. Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive into some of the themes that are being worked out here. One prominent theme that I noticed was, and you kind of alluded to this, was this sort of injustice that's being passed down through the generations. There's pretty deep conversations in this movie. They touch on this idea of what gets passed down. So like Jeff Bridges' partner talks about how his ancestors and what was done to them. There's talk about like the land that was passed on, because they're just sitting there and they're overlooking this sort of landscape, and they're saying, you know, he's talking about what this was once and what it is now, and they're looking at a bank, right? Because banks play a prominent role. This movie about bank robberies, and so you have this idea of how banks kind of had a lot to do with corrupting society and corrupting a whole. Just generations, and not just banks, but kind of what banks represent, this whole the banks are kind of like a villain in the film. Would you agree?
Definitely. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, one of the central questions we have is why are they robbing these banks? You know, we don't really know. We know that Chris Pine's character was the one who hatched the plan, and we don't know why. We do find out at the end of the movie. You know, for one, we know why Chris Pine's brother does it, because he enjoys it. He basically, this is a guy who genuinely likes the chaos and doesn't mind hurting people, and just kind of gets a thrill off the adrenaline of it. And but why does Chris Pine's character do this, and why does he take this risk? And it kind of goes, we eventually find out, and I won't spoil why, but it gets into that theme of generations. It's part of his motivation. And so it comes back to this, to me, this kind of moral question of robbing from the rich for if you have a good reason, right? So the sort of almost Robin Hood ethic that we, I think, inherently sympathize with, especially when it comes to banks that are insured, and we know within a week or so they will have every single dime that was stolen right back with them. It's almost like a no harm, no foul situation, right? So it comes back to, we know that stealing is wrong. It's specifically mentioned that Jesus mentioned stealing is wrong, but there's almost these levels of sin, right? We know that something about stealing from a bank doesn't feel quite as bad as, say, adultery and murder, right? But at the same time, it's maybe might be no harm, no foul for a while, but it definitely, they get in over their heads, right? So there's a scene that you were talking about before where they, and this seems to be indicative of almost every bank robbery movie, where they just get a little too impulsive, right? And so they go to this bank that wasn't a part of the plan. They didn't have a chance to scope it out. And basically, they walk into this place and they know that they've made a huge mistake, because the branch is huge. There's people everywhere. There's all these nooks and crannies that they can't possibly control. You know, everybody's got cell phones, and it's just like, you know, instantly this is gonna go bad, and it does. And then you basically get to this point where it does move beyond just robbing a bank, and suddenly lives are at stake, and so yeah. So anyway, that's a start. What, go for it. What do you got?
Yeah, that's good. There's my goodness. There's a lot that could be said there. And I remember one of my initial thoughts after seeing the film was that there is a strong theme of like right versus wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's a morality tale in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you justify it, right? I mean, you know, like you said, they do a good job of helping us to sympathize with Chris Pine's character, because the way that they develop his motives and his reasons, to a certain extent, you're like, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
You know, I totally get that. It's a good question. You know, it's one of those kind of like, what was I reading? Oh yeah. I was reading something, some Christian leadership material for the job. And they were talking about the whole issue of deception, and they were saying, you know, they were using the reference about, you know, okay, well, if you're in a situation and someone's got a gun to you and they say, you know, and your family's in danger, you know, would you tell the truth from the standpoint of, and I think there's even, I didn't see this picture. My dad watched it and was telling me about it. It's one of the more recent Tarantino films, Inglourious Bastards.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, have you seen that one?
Yeah. That opening scene with Christoph Waltz. Okay. It's a good movie, but they're basically, that opening scene is epic because Christoph Waltz plays this Nazi guard, and he comes, and they're hiding Jews in the basement, and this guy is basically, you know, acts like they're not there and whatever, but then he keeps getting pressed and he eventually gives them up. And that's one of those age-old moral dilemmas, right? Yeah. So we have an example of Rahab in the Bible who lied about the Israelite spies, mm-hmm. and God seems to bless her for it. I mean, she gets included in the genealogy of Jesus, which is pretty remarkable. So could we say that lying for a good reason is acceptable? Or do we say that God's law is God's law? Like, if he says something's wrong, then there should always be a way out, right? There's that other verse about no temptation is easy except what's common to man. God will provide a way out. So part of me's wondered whether you could try to be evasive and to say something that is truthful while also concealing, like say, like, go ahead and check for yourself without saying one way or the other. But then it's like, you feel like you're going to get pressed in the corner where you have to say yes or no. So what do you do in that situation? I don't know. It's really tough. It's a moral dilemma. Yeah.
And I like the way, again, not to get ahead of ourselves here, but I like the way, and I'm going to try to say this without spoiling the ending, but I like the resolution
mm-hmm.
from the standpoint of that question of right, wrong.
Yes. That last scene you're talking about.
The way they dealt with that, in many ways, it reminded me of several moments in the Bible where we see Jesus' interactions with sinners, and God's in direct interaction. I'll give you one example, because there are several examples from the Old and New Testament, but the one example that really, and it's one of my favorite, absolute favorite scriptures in the whole Bible, and I rejoice, I'm so happy that this is in the Bible, the book of Jonah, where Jonah is standing there arguing and justifying himself with God.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that that book ends, because you know God could just crush him for just how arrogant and hypocritical he's being, and the way that God leaves it just kind of open-ended with like, well, Jonah, shouldn't I care about all these people that don't know their right hand from their left and all these cattle? And that's the end of it. That's the end of the narrative. Or even God willing to dialogue and almost kind of like had this reasonable dialogue with Cain.
Mm-hmm.
Cain, whose name in the New Testament becomes synonymous with like the epitome of wickedness.
Yeah.
And here's God basically kind of having this dialogue. Okay, Cain, well, you know, here's Cain like more worried that he's going to get jumped than, dude, you just killed your brother.
Yeah, the first murder ever, by the way. And God doesn't, and that's interesting, God doesn't come right out and kill him and say, well, you killed someone, now I have to kill you. And no, but there's this mercy. And that's what I love about Jonah, too, which is so relevant for our times, right, is that, was it, what was the nation that Jonah had to go to?
The Ninevites.
Ninevites, thank you. Sorry. Goodness sakes. Sunday school, right?
You got to watch your VeggieTales movies.
Right? I know. The Ninevites. But you know that these are some of the most wicked nations at this time. And God sends Jonah to prepare the way for them to be saved from judgment. And I mean, that's God's mercy, and we forget about that, right? That's in the Old Testament. This isn't, you know, like we tend to think that the Old Testament is full of the angry God who wants to kill everyone, but then you have Jonah, where it's like, no, I'm going to, I love the Ninevites. Even in their wickedness, I don't want them to die. That's my heart, is for them to live. That's good, yeah.
And that was the impression that I got in that sort of scene that had that resolution with Marcus and Chris Pine's character.
Yep.
And it's interesting too, going back to the whole thing of the soundtrack, how the soundtrack really helped to accentuate and move the narrative along. There is a moment in the soundtrack where in one of the songs, and he talks about, because there's that moment where basically he recognizes that, how does it go, where he, now I'm drawing a blank here. Please come back. Thought, come back to me. There's that, basically he says to him, he recognizes that if I just kind of, because he's in a position where he could press the issue.
Mm.
And it was another example of great direction where, you know what? It almost kind of reminded me of, and I am going to get to my point, I promise.
It's okay.
I'm just going to kind of take a just sidetrack for a second.
It's all you.
This movie in many ways reminded me of Revenant.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's a lot of similarities that I saw with Revenant.
It's the Leonardo DiCaprio movie from last year, The Bear. Yeah.
Which, best movie then.
Yes.
That's on 15.
Best movie of 15 for sure.
And it was one of the best movie-going experiences. But it reminded me of Revenant, where in that last 20 minutes of Revenant, I thought, okay, I know how this is going to end. But they pleasantly surprised me. Same thing with this movie, where I thought, okay, well, we already know where this is going. But I love that the tension that made you think, okay, I know what to expect. I love the way that they played that out mm-hmm. in terms of like how it was resolved. And basically, Jeff Bridges' character... Oh, I know what I was going to say. Okay, thank you. That thought came back to me. Jeff Bridges' character, remember when he finally kind of has this moment when he could really press the issue, he sort of like leaves him to himself.
Yes.
And there's that moment where he says, this is going to haunt you.
Yes.
And it's very kind of merciful in a way. But the thing that kind of came to mind, and hopefully this is not a stretch, but I know we talked about this previously. So going back to the three crosses.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Is there a sense in which you've got the two thieves and the cross?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a sense in which, without oversimplifying what was a very beautifully complex narrative, so I'm not trying to simplify the film. It is a very complex narrative in a good way. But is there a sense in which you've got the penitent thief and versus the unpenitent thief sort of represented in the two brothers? And is Marcus almost kind of like the gracious God pursuing sinners? But it's this pursuit that doesn't end up in ultimate judgment. Sorry, minor spoiler alert. But it does, to a certain extent, end up in grace. So there's a line in one of the songs in the soundtrack where he says something. The singer says something to the effect of, "My whole life is a chase. My whole life is a chase." And there's that line from Ben Foster's character where he sighs and says, "Lord of the Plains." And there's this sense in which, you know. And this is true of all of us, okay? I think of Romans 3 where he talks about there's none good, there's none seeking after God. And we see it even in the book of Genesis where from the beginning, as soon as man breaks connection with God, we're all fugitives, we're all wanderers, we're all enslaved to our sin, running away from a God who is relentlessly pursuing us in his grace. And I just found that final interaction really in many ways full of grace,
mm-hmm.
where it's like I could press the issue here, but there's a sense in which you being wrapped up in your own warped self-righteousness, because he has kind of deceived himself into thinking, I'm righteous, you know, the banks of the bad guys.
And he has that posture, yeah.
Yeah. That's right. A great posture. There's almost a sense in which it's like God is saying, listen, sin really hurts you more than it hurts me.
It's almost more like an opportunity for grace, right? Because, yeah, to get to actually, he would have to take a step to embrace it. And if he doesn't, if he chooses to go on his current path, then there will be judgment. What I really liked about the movie that was kind of different from a lot of bank robbery movies is that most of the time when you get into these bank robbery stories, you basically, these guys, the people are cocky, they're convinced that they're going to get away with this thing forever, and they're above the law and everything, right? So the two brothers are sitting around a diner at one point, and they said, I remember Chris Pine says something like, you keep acting like we're just going to get away with this, and Ben Foster says, I've never heard of anyone getting away with anything, have you? It's so good, right? And so another great example of dialogue, but it's just almost like, and again, right, this the whole crosses at the mural of the crosses right at the beginning of the film, it sort of like sets the tone of the movie, and it's almost like these guys know the path that they're embarking on is wrong, one, and two, they're headed for judgment, and they're willing to almost sacrifice themselves in that way, knowing that they will be judged. And so what you're talking about at the end there, without spoiling anything, is, again, I think you're right in that Jeff Bridges is almost a Christ character in that way, which is ultimately what God offers to the entire world. It's like, look, you have an opportunity here to make things right, and if you don't, that's your choice, but it's going to haunt you forever, and there are going to be consequences, perhaps eternal consequences. And so that's good. Yeah, I like that. But the thieves on the cross, for sure. Yeah. So If you had to sum up your thoughts on the movie as a whole, just in a couple minutes, just give a mini review, go for it.
And I wrote two questions. My summary will consist not so much of statements, but questions. As I thought through the film, there are two questions that came to mind, and it's based on that last shot. So there's that last shot where I thought it was wheat, but you said it was weeds.
It could have been wheat. I don't know.
But like, it's like the camera goes down, and you're looking at the land. And if you remember the significance of how, remember, there was oil under the ground. And so in my notes, what I wrote down is I thought, okay, like, there's a sense in which this film and this story has kind of come full circle. And there's been this talk throughout the movie about land and territory and heritage and how people define themselves. But when it all came down to it, here's this shot of land. And that land is like extremely symbolic, because remember, the bank was exploiting their mom from the standpoint of like the land and the property. And there was the whole irony of why he was doing what he was doing. And it's all kind of an argument over land. And so the thought that crossed my mind is, when it all came down to it, it had to do with the exploitation of the banks and who owns this land and taking advantage of the poor and what have you. But the question I ask myself is, what is the currency that defines us, right? And I've always, always, always got to take it back to biblical things. And I think back to Abram, the man that God calls and makes his covenant with and promises land. And you just see, even really even just from the beginning of the Bible, right? God makes the heavens and the earth. And Adam and Eve sin in a garden, and they're ejected from land. And Cain rebels and is driven from the land. And it's always this idea of like land and territory and these questions of nation and borders, which is very timely for our election. Right? Because one of the hot topics is, hey, you know, let's make our land and our nation great again, and let's build these walls and borders. And what makes an American, heck, what makes a Texan? And we could even take it deeper, what makes a Christian, right?
Yes.
But these ideas of like, what's the currency that we use as our definition? Do we use the currency of self-righteousness, or do we use the currency of grace? But the other question that comes to mind is like, what makes culture? Is it religion? Is it race? Is it economics? Is it language? Is it industry? And in many ways, the film maybe raises a lot of questions that it doesn't try to answer. And I think that always makes for good art. And you almost want to say, not to get too dogmatic about it, that the more questions that are raised and that are left unresolved, the better the art.
Absolutely.
As opposed to, so that was kind of my takeaway. It's one of those films that's like, I just can't simplify it, but it's one of those films that you're just going to constantly be thinking about and digesting and looking at it from different angles. And, you know, you may have to see it a few times, and even then you're not going to fully, but there's a sense in which those are the best kinds of films.
It's like music in a way, right? Like, I mean, you think about, well, this is partly why I hate country. There's always this very like straightforward like narrative in a pop country song, right? As compared to say like Radiohead or something, where it's very like esoteric and you get something new out of it every single time you listen to it, because you have no idea what he's talking about half the time, and it's very right. And so there's a difference between questions. Those are good. Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. I mean, look, this is a great film. Believe the hype. This is a movie that fires on all cylinders. It's great writing, directing, and everything has a purpose. Rich characters that play off each other really well. It's action-packed, but it's also intimate. It's just got everything. So see it if you can. It is playing in a theater near you right now. I would give it, I think an A- is what I would officially give it. If you had to give a letter grade, what would you offer it up here?
Yeah, I think A- minus is good. I mean, I probably would say A, but yeah, I'm okay with A- minus too.
I think that's all we got, man. So thank you so much for coming on today. This has been a pleasure, seriously.
Thank you. I feel honored to be your guest on the program.
Yeah, so Hell or High Water is the movie. It's playing in a theater near you. Go see it. You will not be disappointed. And keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.